this week.
I am a Pan-Africanist. I have paid the price. I have my badge of honor for sacrificing to fight for my country and fight for Africa.
My conversation with the woman leading the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, Winnie Byanyima. Why she chooses to fight for girls' education and why she joined the resistance as a young woman in her home country of Uganda. Also, we'll bring you the stories of the African recipients of the Women of Courage Awards in Washington.
If we continue to be silent, nothing is going to change.
It's Women's History Month, and Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. It is so good to be with you. It takes courage to stand up for peace, equality and human rights. And every day in dozens of countries and communities worldwide, there are women who do it in the face of unprecedented odds and often at great personal risk. Since 2007, the organizers of the International Women of Courage Award has paid tribute to dozens of women like this, those who fight for justice and for people's fundamental human rights in their home countries and beyond. This year, 180 women from 90 countries were honored at the White House. VOA correspondent Anastasi Tudiesha was there and she met the honorees, and they hail from African countries, some of them. Anastasi joins me here in studio to tell us more. Anastasi, this story really caught my eye, and I'm so glad that you went out and covered this. Now, we know the Women of Courage Award ceremony happens every year, especially those of us who report here in Washington. It's lasted throughout a number of U.S. presidencies. It's now in its 18th year. But tell us more about this, this award ceremony, how it came about, this idea, and how it works.
So the actual full name of this award is Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award, probably because it was established by a Secretary of State, the first female African-American at that, in that position. Her name is Condoleezza Rice. Ooh. So a second point, according to the State Department website, for the awardees to be nominated, it all starts with U.S. diplomatic missions overseas. They identify, then nominate one woman of courage in their host countries. Then the finalist will be selected and approved by senior department officials. Third point, interesting point about this program is that following the very moving award ceremony, will be that the awardees will attend a reception held for them here in Washington. Then will travel to Los Angeles, where they will encounter, well, they will engage with American counterparts in on how to empower women and girls all around the world, and they will also receive a grant.
Early this week here in Washington, these are now dozens of women, right, we're talking about from around the world, and they were honored at the White House, as you said, but you were there. Tell me specifically about the African recipients of
Heidi,
the award.
Let me tell you that Africa was very well represented.
Oh, that's
you
great.
Would have been so proud, and those who look at, who are watching the program can be very proud too. So I met with the three of them. Let me introduce you to them. Number one, and it's not in a particular order, Rabah El Haimar from Morocco, married at 14, contrary nor right, gave birth to a daughter whose father refused to give her identity documents. Rabah engaged in a battle with her estranged husband. She won. And an award-winning documentary by a filmmaker named Deborah Perkin tells her story. It is called Bastards. So that's for Rabah. Agatha Atu Ahire from Uganda. This fellow journalist is also a lawyer and a social justice activist. Her field, human rights, public accountability, and the rule of law in Uganda. Her investigations and revelations have brought change to Ugandan institutions, both private and public. Number three, Fatou Balde from the Gambia, survivor of a female genital mutilation. She advocates for its eradication. Her findings on women's experience during the Jammeh era have been essential to the Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparation Commission's final report.
Wow, these are really amazing women. I feel like almost every year, right, we seem to top ourselves here. Anastasi, you and I talked about this yesterday, about, you know, you were telling me that you had a chance to sit down with the three women from the African continent and actually speak to them one-on-one. What was that experience like?
It has made a lasting impression on me. Being a woman and being a professional, you have to fight, right? But when you meet those women who, with their little hands and their courage, fight in their country, in their communities to make their voices heard, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden find themselves in the spotlight and have this international platform, mm-hmm. all of them have shared that when they stepped into the White House, they cried. So it was very moving to see that, and I was really impressed, which is a very polite way to say that I cried too.
Fantastic. So tell us a little more about these women individually, because we've got some them speaking themselves to on the show here. So kick us off here.
So let's start with Rabab. She was talking to me about her 19-year-old daughter, beaming with pride. And then I asked her, but what about you? What was your dream when you were a little girl? No need to speak Arabic to feel her emotion. Take a look.
When I was a kid, my dream was to go to school because I saw other girls going to school, but I didn't. They were given an opportunity. They studied, but thank God, no harm done. I have accomplished a lot of things, even though I did not get an education.
Anastasi, not all of us, well, one forgets, not everyone gets to have an education here, but everybody has a dream. Tell me a little bit about the next.
So I have asked the same question to the fierce Agatha from Uganda. Her response left me speechless. Take a listen.
You know, I didn't have a privilege to dream a lot. I grew up from a very, very humble, poor family, where even going to primary school, where I think we were paying about $1 or $2 per term, was the tug of war. They would still first chase me home a couple of times. So when you are living a life like that, you actually don't dream. You live a day, you know, at one day at a time.
And the third woman was from the Gambia. What did she tell you?
Absolutely. Last but not least, Fatou from the Gambia. When I asked her what advice she would give to women who, like her, wanted to overcome fear and shame the way she did when she decided to speak out against female genital mutilations, her response fused. Take a listen.
My advice is that you are on the right side, because you are the one that is challenging injustice. So remember, it's not you. It's the oppressor who has the problem. They're the problem. They're the ones who should be ashamed.
Anastasi Tudieshi, thank you so much for bringing us the stories of these women and for your good reporting. Thank you for coming to speak to us. Always a pleasure to have you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when Straight Talk Africa returns, my conversation with the head of UNAIDS, Winnie Byanyima. She talks about politics, power, and progress on women's rights. And she also told me what she believes is still holding too many of Africa's women back. That interview just ahead, back in a moment.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
With Straight Talk Africa, welcome back. She's a Ugandan-born aeronautical engineer, a politician, and a diplomat. She's also the woman currently leading UNAIDS. But Winnie Byanyima has a long history championing the rights of women and girls starting on the African continent. She and I had a conversation recently about the state of women and girls' rights in African countries and the challenges around keeping girls in the classroom. Byanyima spoke to me from Geneva, Switzerland, and told me why she believes school is still the best protector of girls.
I am an African girl. I am a Pan-Africanist. My heart, my home, everything I do, I'm focused there. When I think about myself as an African girl and think of African girls, I see us as stacked at the bottom of the heap. We are in a world that is so unequal, and African girls are at the bottom in that hierarchy of who is important, who matters, who's looked after. And African girls are not in school because of this inequality within countries and between countries that crushes girls. African girls are at the bottom. I fight for them because they are at the bottom of the heap. Today, there are about 100 million girls not in school. The majority of them are in Africa. On the African continent, less than half of the girls actually go on to complete secondary education. In this world that's so globalized and where the economy is more and more knowledge-based, it means they are excluded. I work on HIV, on fighting to end AIDS. We know from our evidence that if a girl completes secondary education, half of the risk of her getting HIV will be gone, just being in a classroom. And that also will keep her from getting pregnant as a teenager, will prevent her from being a victim of sexual violence, will prevent early marriage. Keeping her in school has so many consequences for her, positive consequences for her, including growing the economy. But it's not happening today. It's not happening because, as I said, we are in an unequal world where resources are being extracted and being appropriated by a few at the top. And we've got a leadership that's mostly male that isn't looking at the disparities between men and women within countries, the economic disparities between men and women within countries, political disparities. They are not being tackled. So we need to correct this from the political level to the economic level down to the social level.
Winnie, I've read about your work leading Uganda's first parliamentary caucus and, you know, championing groundbreaking gender equality provisions in the country's 1995 post-conflict constitution. What did you learn from Uganda's experience in prioritizing women and women's rights in post-conflict reconstruction and your work around that? And what are the lessons that you can share that you think the rest of the world can benefit from learning too?
You see, as a teenager, I fled the terror of Idi Amin, a brutal dictator in my country, and then joined movements that fought to restore democracy and human rights in Uganda. One of the commitments was to make a new constitution that would usher in a democratic dispensation and respect for human rights for all people. I was elected. I went to my community and was elected into that assembly. In the assembly, my peers, other women, elected me to be their leader of the Women's Caucus, the first caucus in the country. What I learned there was, first of all, that even as a minority in a parliament, if you have a critical number, if you're organized, if you build your capacity to influence, you can achieve a lot. Because in that constitution, we really transformed the country. Why do I say that? We brought in a quota of one third for women in local government. That is where life is lived by poor women. Today, Uganda has more than 40% women in local government. That means they can influence spending on education, on health, on agriculture, because resources centralized for programs to be implemented. They have a voice in local decision making, equally at the national level. We created new institutions like the Equal Opportunities Commission. So I learned how to influence in a large body where you are a minority. I learned that through that experience. But beyond that, I also learned that it takes more than people in formal political processes to bring about change. We couldn't have achieved what we did without organized civil society, the women's movement backing us and pushing for the reforms we wanted. We couldn't have achieved this without people in government, key people in the ministries, the Ministry of Gender in particular, but also Ministry of Justice and others who were change agents working for gender equality. So I also learned about how to work across government, civil society, parliament to bring about change. I learned how to be part of the global movement. That is how I became part of the global women's movement and eventually went to Beijing to share our story. I learned from South African women how to influence budgets so that spending is equitable, and brought South African women to Uganda to teach us how to do gender budgeting. Then I went around Africa and Asia teaching other women how to use gender budgeting to influence spending. So it was an entry point into the women's movement and to know how to build power from the grassroots up to the global level.
Winnie, I want to turn quickly to your work, of course, at UNAIDS. It focuses in part, of course, on HIV prevention and treatment, among many other things. Do you think there is enough being done to prioritize women's health? And are there any examples that you've seen in African countries where women's health is a core priority and forms part of a women's empowerment agenda?
I lead the United Nations Joint Program on HIV/AIDS. We work in the countries with the highest burden. It's sad to say that when you look at Africa, you see the biggest burden of HIV is in Africa. More than 75% of people living with HIV are in Africa. But you know what, Haiti? New infections are coming down, so we are making progress. Deaths are coming down, so that's progress. But let me tell you something. Today, of the new infections happening on our continent, Sub-Saharan Africa in particular, 3 out of 4 are among girls and young women. If you look at the age cohort of 15 to 24, 3 out of 4 new infections are girls. If you make it even narrower, you find 6 out of 7 infections, girls. That speaks to their higher vulnerability. That speaks to gender inequalities between boys and girls, men and women, that are reflected in sexual relations. It speaks to sexual violence. So I was in your country last week, South Africa. I found great leadership from your president, Cyril Ramaphosa. He was talking to the traditional leaders, the council, and telling them, I have committed. It's going to be my issue to end sexual and gender-based violence in the country. Starting with myself and my leadership, I will not tolerate it, and I want you to sign on with me. You see, unless we tackle some social norms that are tolerating sexual violence, that close our eyes to this injustice, that socialize boys to be violent in sexual relations, we will not end HIV/AIDS. That's a major inequality between boys and girls. But added to that, to use public policies to equalize boys and girls, that's why I fight for their education, for universal secondary education, so they are both in school and they are able to be empowered with sexual education that's appropriate, protect themselves. So we have a lot to do, Heidi, and we can do it if we can get our governments to put the money behind the key priorities, the education of our children, the health of our people, the sectors which give them jobs and incomes like agriculture, like tourism, and not waste money in buying more weapons, killing more people, building huge bureaucracies that don't matter, building security systems that aren't needed. We need leadership that cares and that uses evidence to allocate resources and grow economies.
Are you seeing any other trends around women's empowerment, especially in our African countries, that give you hope? And are there trends that you haven't mentioned before but that worry you the most still?
Okay. What gives me hope? What gives me hope is that Africa has been making some progress on getting women into leadership. We have a target as Africa to get to that 33% of women in parliaments that is in the Beijing platform for action. It's a shame we are not there yet, but I see some progress in the numbers, affirmative action, quotas being used to propel. Rwanda has 61% women in parliament, and at least a third of the countries have passed that 33% in parliament. If we get more women in leadership, as presidents, as parliamentarians, we will begin to see some equalizing in health, in education, and so on. It will happen. Secondly, I'm hopeful about girls. I see that girls today, at least those who are in school, are connecting through technology. And with that, I see more empowerment of girls. I'm seeing girls who are more aware of the world around them, who are making more claims on their governments, on their leaders, on their communities, on their parents. That is positive. But I must be careful about also the negative sides. What digital technology is also doing, it empowers on the one hand, but it empowers on the other. I also have to be careful about political leadership. We are getting some more women in, but we are seeing regression on the democratic front. We are seeing countries that had been making progress falling back into military rule, losing even their territory and their sovereignty to rebel groups. We are seeing a pushback on human rights. We are seeing these laws that are coming in to criminalize minorities. But I do have some optimism because also globalization and digital technology is empowering and making girls and women more assertive.
You said earlier, you know, you're an African girl, and I want to go back to that African girl, but it starts with a speech you gave recently at the NORAD conference where you said, quote, I'm a woman of the resistance. Please share some of your personal stories, especially the part about leaving your PhD studies in Uganda to join the resistance and why you say you have never looked back.
Yes, I am an unapologetic African girl. Because, I mean, to be where I am and the journey I've taken has been a journey of resistance. It's true. I fled Amin. That was already a resistance. Leaving Makerere University, where I had my friends and I was enjoying myself, abandoning that and going to be a refugee in the UK, was saying no to some of the things that I was seeing there, the terror of Idi Amin and what it was doing to us girls and women. In Europe, I joined groups that were now resisting that terror and fighting for democracy and human rights, Ugandan groups. I learned how to be part of resistance there. We won the resistance. But before we won it, at some point, I had won a scholarship. I was going for my PhD studies, fully funded. I was the first black girl to win a Zonta International Amelia Earhart Fellowship. I abandoned that and went to fight for my country. That's why I say I am a Pan-Africanist. I have paid the price. I have my badge of honor for sacrificing to fight for my country and fight for Africa. I don't hesitate to say that. But back home, we won a revolution. We empowered people. We brought grassroots democracy. We brought women in local government. We did many, many things that I will forever be proud of. But all of that was about resisting. And what were we resisting? We were resisting neocolonialism, because we are survivors, we Africans. We suffered 400 years of slavery, 100 years of colonialism, and now we're under a neocolonial state where our economy was on the fringe, right? On the margins of central, rich European, American economies, tied in relationships that were unequal. Our aim was to restructure those relationships, get into a global economy where there's justice. But within that, I had also my agenda as a feminist, that with justice must mean justice for men and women too. It can't be justice for our country where women are subservient to men. So I had two resistances, a resistance to neocolonialism and its impact on a poor African country, and a resistance to patriarchy, where men, poor men, also exploit poor women. So those were my struggles. That's why I call myself a woman of resistance.
Winnie Byanyima there, the executive director of UNAIDS, speaking to me from Switzerland. And that is our show this week. Thanks to my guests and to the more than 300 TV and radio affiliate stations bringing you the show across the African continent. Thank you for always watching, for always listening, joining us on television, radio, and online. Happy Women's History Month to you. I will see you next time. Until then, it's goodbye.